Okay, I want to talk about Peter the Great today. And, you know, the Russian Empire is one of those empires that continued, after the four empires disappeared with World War I. Well, the Russian Empire continues, so it continues under a somewhat different way with what became the Soviet Empire, because that's what it became. And of course, with the end of the Soviet Union in 1991-92, the Soviet Empire collapsed. The Soviet Union collapsed, and I guess the only remaining empire in the world is that of the United States. Which is a more informal empire, but still one that is out there almost everywhere with military bases everywhere. So the rise and fall of empires is obviously a theme of this course. And the Russian Empire, the state of Muscovy, had already expanded greatly. But it's really Peter the Great. It's the big guy who expanded Russia. His territorial size enormously. And so, you know, Muscovy had been one of the tributaries of the Mongols who sacked Kiev in the 1230s after pouring into Russia and what now is Ukraine. And Muscovy was a princely state, and it gradually expanded in size, reaching the southern Ural Mountains and the Caspian Sea, and emerging as a dynastic a state. But yet, Muscovy was considerably less important than the Commonwealth of Poland, Lithuania, which was considerably much greater and subject to struggles with and influenced by that state. And it's what Peter the Great did was he pushed back the neighbors who had blocked the expansion of Muscovy, that is Sweden, whom he defeats in a battle worth noting in Poltava, P-O-L-T-A-V-A, it's in the book, 1709, Poland, and the Ottoman Turks. Peter the Great adds territory beyond the Ural Mountains along the Caspian Sea at the expense of the Turks. Like all of his successors, he dreamed of conquering the Turkish capital of Constantinople, that is Istanbul, which had given him control of the straits, would have given him control of the straits, the Dardanelles Straits there, the passage between Europe and Asia leading to the Black Sea. And I mean, all this stuff really matters, because all these events now with the problems in Georgia, and that's a very, very, you know, delicate, a strange situation where, you know, the great power now, the United States, finds itself rather incongruously arguing that Kosovo, which should be obviously independent. I remember going to Pech in Kosovo when I was a kid, that it's a little hard to argue that Kosovo should be independent, and that what was the territorial unit of Serbia should not be respected. I agree with this. Kosovo should be independent, and to argue that Tibet should be, you know, should be free, and I agree with that. And then to turn around and argue that the people in Georgia, who are not Georgians, should not have the same rights that the people in Kosovo have. The whole thing, the presentation in the press is absolutely hypocritical and just bizarre. But the only point of that little diatribe, in parentheses, was that the Black Sea really does still matter a lot, and that Peter the Great was the first of the Russian czars to dream of this access on to the Black Sea. And then finally, controlling the Straits of Constantinople, and Catherine the Great, they all like to call themselves the Great, she would make this an important part of her policy, but she doesn't get there either. And in the 19th century, the Russian czars are still trying to get there as well. Peter's new fleet, we'll talk about his new fleet, which he oversaw and indeed in a very minor way helped build himself, sails down the Don River in 1698, and it takes the Turkish port of Azov, A-Z-O-V, on the Sea of Azov, A-Z-O-V, and this gave them access to the Black Sea. But then they're forced to back up. They lose, and they're forced to surrender Azov to the Turks after an unsuccessful war. And so Peter the Great, despite his dramatic expansion of the Russian Empire, does not get this outlet on the Black Sea. But what does change, what the battle represents is, of course, is Poltava, is that Russia's participation in European affairs had been totally minimal. I mean, it's a story often told, indeed, and told in the book that you're kind enough to read, that I think it was Louis XIV, that his equivalent of Minister of Foreign Affairs sends a formal letter to a Russian czar, who, it couldn't have been Louis XIV, but one of those dudes, it might have been, to a czar who'd been dead for 12 years. Russia was that far away, and it was not in the consciousness of the great powers. But after one of Peter's victories, the Russian ambassador in Vienna reported that the news of Peter's victory began to fear the Tsar as formerly as they feared Sweden. And it's very difficult to us to imagine, you know, a fear of Sweden. But the fear of the last real, you know, Gustavus Adolphus during the Thirty Years' War was the last really sort of major Swedish interlude in continental European affairs. Though Poltava doesn't come, the defeat of Poltava doesn't come till 1709. Voila. But what he does is that there's no other European state expanding their empires overseas, in the case of the Spanish and the English, that adds so much territory on land to its empire. Between the 1620s and the 1740s, the land of the empire, the Russian Empire, increases from 2.1 million square miles to 5.9 million square miles. Now, to be sure, in Siberia, in the far reaches of the north, of North Asia, this empire amounted to little more than a series of trading posts. And it took a very long time for any sort of semblance of Russian authority from Moscow and soon from St. Petersburg, for reasons that we'll see, to reach there. But nonetheless, Peter the Great creates this huge empire that will have, over the long run, an enormous influence in European affairs, because after all, European Russia is part of Europe, and will have an enormous influence on Asian affairs as well. Witness the Russo-Japanese War in 1904-1905 that the Russians lose. And this is a key moment in the evolution of revolutionary politics in Russia, as we shall see a little later on. Now, what about Peter the Great? I used to ask my friend Paul Bushkovich to come in and Kali to give the lecture, and then I got so interested in it that I did some reading on my own. Lindsay Hughes and various other people, and so put this together last semester, because he is not a terribly engaging or, you know, warm personality in many ways, since he enjoyed watching people being tortured, including his own son. But he is an interesting person, and one of the things he does, and I guess this is one of the, you know, the things that we put in neon from this lecture, is he opens up Russia, which had no secular influences at all, to Western ideas. And so this is an extraordinarily important and transforming an accomplishment of Peter the Great. He emerges from the violent world of boyar. Boyars are the nobles. Junkers are the Prussian nobles. Boyars, B-O-Y-A-R, are the Russian nobles and royal politics. Peter was the first child of his father's second wife, and thus a potential threat to the ambition of the relatives of the first wife. His mother and her allies among the boyar, that is the nobles, overthrew the regents in 1689. Peter's rule is from 1682 till his death in 1725. There were no strict rules for the succession of the Tsar. It's basically just kind of a family, uncomely family battle royal in which there were bloody settlings of scores. And there was no foreign minister. The Boyars' Council, that is the Council of the Nobles, literally met in the throne of the palace. And it became known as the Duma. Eventually, in 1905, Nicholas II will be forced to grant a Duma, an assembly to Russia, and then he withdraws, eliminates basically all of its rights, and then the Duma, of course, will come back later on. Now, Peter is one of those cases in European history where the one person's personality and interest does make an enormous difference, because he is an absolute ruler. He can do what he damn well pleases. And he is personally responsible for the reforms, the opening up of Russia to a considerable extent to European ideas, to Western European ideas. This is something that he does himself. As a boy, he was very smart, and he was very interested in science. He wanted to know always how things work. He was fascinated with astrolabes and was interested in sailing. Now, Russia doesn't have a port, so he's interested in sailing, learns about sailing on lakes and ponds and rivers. It does have a port, but it's frozen, you know, it's frozen all the time. But his travels took him into contact with observatories, museums, hospitals, botanical gardens. When he goes, he's fascinated by gardens. When he goes to Europe on his big boy trek through Europe, I mean, he goes around and he visits all of these, you know, botanical gardens, and he sketches things. He's constantly sketching the way things work, the way things are. He had this intellectual curiosity that really defied the kind of orthodox religious skepticism about any kind of rational belief. I mean, this permeated not only the Russian Orthodox Church, but it permeates the Catholic Church as well. I mean, look what happens to Galileo, who was lucky not to have been burned at the stake by his friend the Pope. He was interested in math and in geography, and thus in maps and map making. And what he does is he takes this archaic state structure in which literally nothing had been written down. It's all just, you know, passed down from word to mouth. He transforms Russia into a European absolute monarchy with much in common with Frederick the Great, with Sweden, with Austria, the Austria of the Habsburgs, with Spain, and with France. He tries not only to copy European absolutism, but to open up Russia to commerce, realizing that trade meant wealth, and that wealth meant improvements in the lives of the Russian people. More about that in a while. So he makes Russia a military power, indeed arguably a modern military power, at least in the 17th and early 18th century sense, and he injects European culture into Russia. Now, just as an aside, but it's one that we'll come back to, particularly in your reading, the tension in Russia between an absolute repugnance for Western influence and the constant assertion that Russia traditional ways of doing things are the right way of doing things, long identified with people who would be called Slavophiles, their tensions with Westernizers would last right through Russian intellectual history in the 19th century. I remember when I was, you know, a student of one of the biggest classes at the University of Michigan, go blue, I'm so sad this weekend, was Russian intellectual history, and we would read the Slavophiles and we'd read the Westernizers, of course taught by the late Russian scholar of Russia, Arthur Mendel, and it was fabulous to read these people as they debated, you know, what will happen to Russia, the kind of Westernizers and those in between, and a lot of them, they were writing from Paris in the 19th century, and some of them were just great, great writers, and it was this kind of intellectual energy. But it came down to this theme that still is so important, was already so important, is that what is Russian that should be kept uniquely Russian and closed to outside influence, and what is Russian that should be modified by being open to non-religious influences that come from other places. And this is not just a uniquely Russian tale, as obviously you can see. Now, what about Peter himself? He was, somebody figured out, at least 6'7". Now, that's just huge. That's tiny in the NBA now. But the guards, the sort of giants, they were called, who guarded Frederick the Great, were giants because they were 6 feet tall. The average person was about 5'4" in France. Napoleon, who was always considered to be kind of a dwarf, a midget, really was about he wasn't at all. He was just sort of corpulent, but he was the average, increasingly corpulent. He was the average height of most people in France. So Peter the Great was a big guy, 6'7". He had extremely small hands, very small feet, which meant he sort of lurched and stumbled sometimes when he walked, particularly because he drank just enormous quantities. And he had these odd kind of facial tics that he couldn't really help at all. We don't have a documentary showing Peter the Great in action for obvious reasons, but the people that he visited when he was snatching huge roasts off the table at fancy parties in London commented on these sort of facial tics that he had that would bend his face, and he had a misshapen lower lip. And his head sometimes when he was talking would seem convulsed to the right. It would kind of move to the right all the time, and he was so much bigger than everybody else, and so people really were not taken aback, because this was a time when physical imperfections were commonplace. I mean, you couldn't go anywhere without seeing people who nature had given in many ways a very bad deal, along with crushing poverty. But the fact that Peter was a czar and was rather scary in his temperament, because he had a rather bad temper, meant that he could be alarming, he could be scary. His cruelty, his generosity was legend, but so was his cruelty. Several times at public executions in 1698 and 1699, he brushed the executioner away, grabbed the axe, and did the dirty work himself, chopping off a head or two. In 1718, he ordered a man kept alive after being horribly tortured so he could be tortured some more and suffer as long as humanly possible. All officials from the chancelleries that he had created and all of the officers were obliged to attend this torture scene as a way of kind of warning them that, you better not mess around. Now, remember, this is a time, as we'll see in a while, where the Tsar was on the road a lot, and distances in the Russian Empire are enormous. And when he is gone from Moscow and then St. Petersburg, there was always this tendency to have these sort of cabal, to get together and sort of plot. And his son has the bad idea of getting involved in this later, as we shall see. Yet there were incidents that his merciful side came through as well. But when it came to treason, he was less likely to be merciful, as the case of Alexei, his ill-fated son, would demonstrate. Now, Peter the Great, one thing is clear, is he had an enormous ambivalence about his role and his image as a czar. His second wife was a Latvian peasant maid, and this horrified the boyars who thought that this was, it was unbecoming. How can you marry a Latvian to begin with if you were Russian and marry somebody who was a commoner? He was capable, and there are a lot of paintings of him dressing up and playing the role of a czar, dressing in fancy clothes, but there are more images of him identified with horribly worn boots with his toes sometimes sneaking through at the end that seem to reflect his great personal thrift, wearing stockings it was said that he darned himself, and a battered hat that he kept on wearing that he had worn at the Battle of Poltava in 1709, complete with a bullet hole that supposedly tore through it, missing his head. He liked the company of ordinary people, and this was a constant trait He identified himself with the Russian people, and more about this in a while. He avoided carriages. He liked to walk. He would leave the carriage behind, dismissing carriage drivers who were more well-dressed than he was, and his guards. He ignored carefully crafted seating plans at dinner. He jumped from table to table, eating standing up. He didn't like to sit down very much. His back hurt. Or walking around. He couldn't stay still very long. When he was lodged, he liked living in your basic Russian wooden peasant house, such as you could find on the outskirts of Moscow. One of the things that's very true about Moscow right into the 20th century is that you had all sorts of peasants living in the edge of Moscow, living in these wooden houses. And he liked that. He said he slept well in these wooden houses. And that probably is because of his very unhappy childhood, listening to relatives shouting at each other and plotting to kill each other in the big house. And he never liked Moscow, and we'll see more about that in a minute, in part because of its overwhelming religious influence. And that's and one reason why he builds, besides the quest for a port on the sea, why he builds a St. Petersburg. When traveling abroad, he refused the fancy lodgings that were left for reserved for such distinguished visitors. In 1717, in Paris, Lindsay Hughes reports, he went to a private house instead of the Louvre. The museum had a big palace, which, as I said before, is where the small boy Louis XIV lived, and then was burned in 1871. And so he just went to and rented a private house and fell asleep almost immediately. He loved sleeping on ships. He said he thought that the rocking of the waves rocked him to sleep, and so he liked doing that. Legend has him eating peasant food, cabbage soup, porridge, meat with pickled cucumbers, ham and cheese, and kvass, which is a drink which I've actually tasted from fermented black bread. But he was not indifferent to foreign food. Somebody found an order. He ordered 200 bottles of Hermitage wine. Hermitage is a really wonderful, now this horribly overpriced wine from the Drôme on the left bank of the Rhône, not very far away from where we live, but it's totally out of price. But Hermitage was a wine that was known by connoisseurs in the 17th and 18th century and ever since then. And so, you know, for all the talk about eating, eating cabbage and eating with ordinary people, even then, Hermitage cost a lot of money. And he ordered 200 good bottles of Hermitage wine. So, voila, I wish I had been invited to these things. He was very informal. I mean, he said that it's legend that he just sort of grabbed these huge chunks of meat and start gnawing on them like, you know, you would on a hot dog or something like that at a Yankee game. Except that these other people were already dressed up, and the meat and the gravy was flying over them as he just sort of walked around gnawing on this stuff. Sophia Charlotte of Brandenburg, I don't know who the hell that is, but it's got to be some royal hanger-on, wrote that it is evident that he has not been taught how to eat properly, but she liked his natural manner and informality. The King Frederick of Denmark found him ill-mannered and inappropriate. He liked to masquerade, and again, this is his personal ambivalence about his own role, hanging around with ordinary people, sleeping in peasant lodgings, and that sort of thing. He liked to dress up as a sailor, and one thing that he always did when he went on his grand tour is he always took fake names, as if he was, you know, signing into a hotel as, you know, Mr. and Mrs. John Smith. He would take the name of a commoner. I mean, he didn't sign into a hotel, you know, Peter the Great or whatever, but he would go in with a name that wasn't his. And again, this is just his personal ambivalence about who he was and his uncertainty about the role that he had in his own family. Yet, and so this was a play acting that was part of his life. These ornate masquerades and charades that are part of his complexity reveals something about his identity. Then when you see these portraits of him, he looks very czar-like. He looks like one of these royal, you know, people that were painted all the time. In 1697, he goes west with the name of Peter Mikhailov, and even in his own account books, which he kept very carefully about how much money he had spent, because he wasn't radin, he wasn't a cheapskate, but he really, you know, he paid attention to expenses, to royal expenses, personal expenses. He refers to himself with a variety of names and titles as captain this, colonel that, general that. And he's not trying to hide his identity of the future. It was very obvious to see who he was, his handwriting recognized by experts. But role-playing takes on dimensions of the state. I mentioned, I don't remember what context, the other day that the most famous example is the drunken assembly. It's sort of a mock parallel government with his buddies. It has personnel who are his buddies, those in favor, lots of eating, drinking, etc. It has its statutes, it's sort of this mock constitution, and its rituals that involve basically getting wasted. Again, this is part of his split personality about who he was. And if Hughes is correct, I mean, this is part of him saying that being a czar is more than just dressing up and playing the role and going to fancy dances and hanging around with fancy people who don't do a damn thing. That you have to do the work, you have to walk the walk, and that he did, and that you had to manifest strength and firmness and bravery and worthy deeds that would be recognized as being real deeds by contemporaries. And he constantly warns his son, who was kind of a ne'er-do-well, that you better work harder, you better work a little harder, pay more attention to what you're doing. You better care about military things more than you do. This is what I'm telling you, you better do. You better listen to what I'm doing. But sometimes he just, he would drink a lot and eat a lot because he just needed to relax. I mean, being a czar was a busy job. He got up at 4 a.m. He was at his office before anybody else was. And people began, like in any business, to be attentive to, am I there early enough? Did he see me that I am still here when it's getting dark? Of course, it gets dark in the winter, in St. Petersburg about noon. But he loved practical things. He loved firefighting, for example. He had a passion for fireworks, explosives, cannon fire, drums. He played the drums. He loved dancing, and he loved religious singing. He loved the sort of choir music of Russian Orthodox services. He loved to play chess, and he loved to play billiards. And, as I already said, he loved mathematical instruments and telescopes. He carried a telescope with him wherever he went, and he knew how to use it, and he knew what he was looking for. And he loved globes. He loved to see where things were. He liked to see that they mapped parts of Siberia that people didn't know what was there. It was rather like parts of Africa before the 1880s, just these big sort of blanks. Because nobody had ever been there. And he was interested in that. He was self-taught. You didn't have to go to some fancy school if you were a czar, to be a czar in training. You had tutors, as all these folks did. And he made spelling mistakes, which you can see. I don't read Russian, but he made spelling mistakes when he wrote. His handwriting was awful, and bad handwriting is the nemesis of historians, to be sure. But he built a private library. And it wasn't just full of religious books. It was practical books about fortifications, hydraulics, artillery, navigation, and shipbuilding. But he also, I said, he sang religious music. He had many religious books, the kind of standard liturgical texts that were the stuff of religious enthusiasm, and more modern theological works in the Russian Orthodox tradition. Another point about this sort of ambivalence about being czar is that he often made a point of choosing his most trusted advisors from the ranks of commoners, and gave them the right to become titled after a certain amount of time in the royal bureaucracy. But sometimes he had a tendency to pick people whom he liked a lot but were totally unqualified. Military commanders who weren't very good. But what he does is he cuts off Russian absolutism from this totally religious culture that represented 100% of the official culture in a real sense, the culture of pre-Petrine, that is pre-Peter, Russia. Because Russian culture was entirely religious. If you went to Poland, where I go often, as I've said before, if you went to Krakow, where Copernicus worked, and I've been in Copernicus, his workroom is just absolutely fantastic. And Cracovia, you had a major university. It was an important center of learning, a diffusion of scientific ideas in the scientific revolution and later of Enlightenment ideals. In Vilnius, which is the capital of Lithuania, you had a university as well. But there wasn't a university in Russia. There was no equivalent of the Royal Society that you're reading about in London that was very important in the diffusion of the scientific revolution. There's nothing like the Académie des Sciences, the Academy of Sciences in Paris, which was founded in 1666. There's no legal tradition, and so there's no law school. There's no medical school. There's no secular culture. 90% of all the books that were published before Peter were devotional texts in the church. There was no word literally in Russian for the state or for the monarchy or for the government. They did not exist. The state was an abstraction, but in the person of the Tsar, it was a reality. Now the boyars in the 1660s and 1670s, some of them began to learn Latin and Polish. And diplomacy is still in Latin until the end of the 17th century, and then, as you know, it becomes French. What about his accomplishments besides the ones I've already mentioned, to which I'll return a little bit? Moscovy had already conquered the Volga Basin in the 16th century, where the nomadic Tatars were, T-A-T-A-R-S. This was important because it's the black earth region of rich agricultural there. And what happens there is what happens in Russia is what happens in Prussia as well, and in other parts of Eastern Europe, particularly in the Habsburg domains, is you have, to make a very bad pun, a resurfacing of the region by people forced into serf contracts. They become not contracts, they become legally part of the land, literally. And so this follows the arrival the expansion of serfdom expands along with the Russian Empire. They already held Siberia, and they reached the Pacific Ocean in the 1640s. So this, I already said what the number of miles, square miles that were increased, but and increases from 6 to 16 million of the population. They expand north to Arkhangel, so this gives them a port, but a frozen one, and as I already said, south and southeast to the expense of the Turks. But Peter wanted a navy. And you know, if you're going to have circular reasoning, if you want to have a navy, you have to have a port, and if you're going to have a port, then you have to have a navy. Why not? And so he first built a navy on rivers using Dutch shipmasters from Amsterdam. He once said that if he wasn't the Tsar of all the Russians, what he would want to be would be be an English admiral. He learned Dutch, and Dutch is a very difficult language. In 1696, while the Turkish War went on, or one of them, he went off to Western Europe incognito as an embassy soldier. Again, it was part of his gamesmanship, his pretend games. And there he learned carpentry in a very serious way. He went to the Leiden Medical School because he wanted to see how you dissected bodies. And so he went there too. And then he went to London, and he, along the Thames, the major port, obviously of the world, then along with Amsterdam, and he learned shipbuilding there as well. And because the building of ships was to him the application of rationality, of reasoned thinking and experimentation, this got him interested in the scientific revolution. There's nothing too surprising about that. It's the essence of the scientific revolution. He may have even attended a Quaker meeting, but we're not sure about that. But the problem was, if you have a basically landlocked power and want to get to the sea, then you better have a navy. He'd learned to sail when he was young, but on the river. And this also, by the way, gets him interested in Baroque and these kinds of Baroque masquerades that he had back in Moscow and then in St. Petersburg as well. So in all of this, what he does is he makes, to use an expression that I've already used before in the context of absolutism, he makes the boyar, while he's building his navy and expanding Russia, he makes the boyar junior partners in absolutism. That phrase again. Now, there are only about 200 to 300 boyar families. They own, by the way, 40,000 serfs. Own 40,000 serfs. Just these 200 to 300 families. And they build huge houses in the 17th century in Moscow with very old-fashioned traditional Russian architecture. The empire, the Russian empire, was rather like Charlemagne's empire in 800 and the coronation at Aachen or Aix-la-Chapelle and all of that. And that you have this bureaucracy that's a very, very, you know, it's not really a bureaucracy, but you've got these royal officials representing the royal will, but the actual impact in this vast expanse of the Russian Empire isn't that great. There's nobody telling people what to do on a day-to-day or even a month-to-month basis. But yet there's an enhanced sense of obligation to the czar of all the Russian people. There is there's an advanced sense of state and of organization. And that also is one of the things to put in neons. He creates committees of advisors that in many ways are not that different than the kinds of ministries that would evolve in Western absolute rulers, absolute state and states, and in non-absolute states as well. And so by 1708 and 1709, he has created a more European-style administration for this vast empire. Now, he wants to build a capital city, and that's where St. Petersburg comes from. It had been Swedish territory, and his victories gives him this land. I once went to visit his, you know, the summer palace that he created and that Nicholas II loved so much there. And so he constructs this new capital. Now, what's important about the construction of St. Petersburg, I don't know how few people have ever been there. I haven't been there for a very, very long time. But that this city is not like Moscow at all. When you look at Moscow, you see these old traditional, the skyline is dominated by churches, the influence of the Russian Orthodox Church. St. Petersburg is completely different. It is a it's an example of classic great power absolute urban planning. It has a long boulevard, the Nevsky Prospect, very important in 1917. The most dominant buildings are not churches, they are state buildings, they are state structures. So it's a different place. It reminds you of Madrid, it reminds you of Berlin, it reminds you of Versailles, and it reminds you of the post-Osman Paris, that is post-1850s and 1860s Paris. It is the example of the imperialism, what I call the imperialism of the straight line, where you have large boulevards that you can march armies down to, reviewing stands, and all of that. Totally different than Moscow. And the religious leaders did not like Peter, because Peter is bringing in to Russian culture foreign elements. They're already suspicious of the implementation or the annexation of Baroque religious forms, architectural forms, and liturgical influences from Austria and from Central Europe. And now they got a guy who's telling the boyar's women to dress like Western European women. And he's telling at a time when beards meant a great deal religiously, he's telling the men to shave off their beards. He's telling the men to wield forks and knives as well as weapons, and to adopt Russian, non-Russian customs to bring them into Russia. And so there's tremendous tension with the church. But he remains, you know, he is a true believer, but he is bringing into Russian religious culture changes that were deeply resented. Some aristocrats began to put on Western-style wigs, such as you could find at the court of Versailles. Women had to wear high heels and sort of tottering along and falling, you know, on the cobblestones, wearing high heels and European-style dresses. And he promulgates decrees as czar about daily life. And this is a big transformation. As to his son, his son was more under the influence of these traditional religious influences. And he is plotting against his own father when and Peter, on one of his trips, has to return back to Russia. And in 1716-1718, Alexei had taken his mother's side in the divorce and did not like the Latvian peasant second wife. He also didn't like military service. He was lazy. And his father said, "I see you're spending more of your time in idleness than in taking care of business at this crucial time." But Alexei doesn't get the point, and he begins to plot in various ways with dissident boyars, and he goes off and gets the support of the Emperor of Austria to wage a war against his own father. Terrible idea. And when he returns, his father orders him tortured. And under torture, Alexei, who probably dies of cold, not of torture, in a very frozen cell, named boyar accomplices. And these people are toast, obviously. The son died of probably TB, but it related to all this other business in his weakened state. And so that was the end of the son. But what lasted longer than Alexei was the Europeanization of Russian culture. Peter the Great has books translated from the West, including John Locke, into Russian. And this itself was a remarkable accomplishment, because after all, the Russian Orthodox churchmen had been not interested in the Renaissance at all, not interested in the scientific revolution at all. And by 1710, Russian students are being sent abroad to foreign universities, particularly in Italy, but also in France and in England. And they're studying practical things like marble work and metal work and copper work, and not just shipbuilding, but they're also studying the life of the mind. In a way, it's possible to argue, which is what I'm arguing, and I'm not the first to do it, but Peter the Great was in many ways himself a child of European rationalism, of scientific culture, of rationality, and of, at least in the earlier stages, of the Enlightenment. He was not against the church, but he thought that people were wasting time being monks, and monks and other people were all over the place in their Russian Orthodox equivalent. He would believe whatever wag once said of monks, you know, I sleep, I eat, I digest. And they prayed, of course, and to him this was not useless because it didn't serve the state, it didn't serve the dynastic interests of the dynasty, which he identified with the Russian people. He did say he did not ever imagine the abandonment of the table of ranks, which has set everybody in a hierarchy, that not for a minute. And we're talking about the end of the 17th and 18th century. But he believed that it was important to take the tools of science, to take the tools of rational thought, and apply them to the good of the state, even if he saw that good of the state as in you know, ships that could lob cannon balls even further against hostile ships and that kind of thing. But he founds the first Russian museum, the first school of navigation, the first school of this and that. There are 100 times more books, pamphlets, prints, and maps produced in Russia under the time of Peter the Great than there had been in the whole previous century. Peter, as Lindsay Hughes has argued, was highly suspicious of any alternative to state service, especially the monastic way of life, which I've already said. But he thought that it should be channeled through state obligations, be there taxes or labor duties. At the same time, he's equally suspicious of the godless. So he remained very Russian, but it was the importation of more Western ways of looking things that were very important. He wrote once that the chief thing is to know your duties and our edicts by heart and not put off things until tomorrow, like his son did. For how can a state government exist if edicts are not put into use, et cetera. Their lives should be better. That the concept of the state was fundamentally new to Russia, but gradually came into existence, and his accomplishments had a lot to do with that. He wrote his son in 1704, he said, "I may die tomorrow, but be sure that you have little pleasure if you fail to follow my example. You must love everything that contributes to the glory and honor of the fatherland. You must love loyal advisors and servants, whether they be foreigners or our own people, and spare no effort to serve the common good." The common good comes right out of enlightened thought. That right comes out of Locke and those folks. "If my advice is lost in the wind and you do not do as I wish, I do not recognize you as my son." And that, in the end, what came in the long run. He remained a fanatically Russian patriot, the father of his people. His admiration for foreign things and approaches was tempered by, as Hughes argues, his devotion to Russia, which he oversaw. The common good became a real concept, and one that, unfortunately, some of his successors didn't take terribly seriously. But you know, in conclusion, he defiantly, deliberately, and effectively broke with tradition. And in doing so, he made himself sort of an outsider to traditional Russian ways of looking at this thing. And so this ambivalence that was part of his personal life, the way he lived, would be a constant theme in subsequent Russian history, and still in many ways is today, between Slavophiles and Westernizers, those are the people that look inside to Russia to finding what they think to be eternal truth, and those people that want to temper such looks with a look to the West. And that, in Neon, is what Peter the Great did above all, and for which he shall boast most be remembered. Next time, to the Enlightenment, and some people whom you might not think of at first glance who seemed terribly enlightened. See you on Wednesday.